Thank you for coming. My name is Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here. And today is the first Sunday of Lent. So some of us were here just a few days ago on Ash Wednesday, which was the first day of Lent, but today is the first Sunday of Lent. And Lent, of course, is this season of self-reflection, of self-examination. It's a kind of a serious season, a somewhat sober season, but it's also a really positive season because we get to reflect on things that are going to be transformative in our lives. We get to think about how we want our lives to be, and we get to invite God into that space to be empowered to change, not just our own selves, but to become people that can be a positive force in the world, people that can bring change into the world as well. So it's serious, but it's a really positive season. And we are, season of Lent, we're going to be looking at something called the Sermon on the Mount. Now, Lent is 40 days, right? It's actually 40 days if you don't include the Sundays, right? But the 40 days of Lent represents Jesus' time of 40 days and nights in the wilderness. He went out into the wilderness to be tempted. You may remember that we, back in, just after Christmas, at the time called Epiphany, right after Christmas, we looked at Jesus' baptism, and we saw that he had this epiphany that God is love, that it was like an enlightenment, that he was loved, fully loved, and that the way of God is, in the world is love. And we can trace Jesus' first early part of his life from that baptism in Matthew's gospel into the wilderness. He goes into the wilderness right after his baptism, spends 40 days and 40 nights there, and then he begins his ministry of teaching. So we're going to pick up for Lent the time just after his time in the wilderness. It's a little bit sort of unusual that. We're also going to pick up with some themes that aren't, they're traditional Lent themes, but you may remember in this last series we've been in, we've been looking at things like fasting and simplicity and letting things go. And those are kind of normally the things that we reflect on in Lent, but there's so much more to Lent. So today we're going to sort of do an introduction to what the rest of this series is going to be. And I hope you'll leave with a sense of anticipation, excitement about these next few weeks together as we go on this journey through Lent. So we're going to focus in, as I said, on what's become known as the Sermon on the Mount. It's one of Jesus' first teachings in the Gospel of Matthew. It probably wasn't necessarily all said in one go, in one sermon, if you like. We get some of that sort of sense because in Luke's gospel, some of these similar sayings of Jesus that appear in Matthew kind of are spread out and they're in a different location than not necessarily on a mountain. But the writer of Matthew has gathered together many of the sayings of teachings of Jesus into kind of five sections, what are known as five discourses. And this is the first of those. So he's kind of brought together, Jesus is bringing together some teaching that really is some of his most famous teaching. It's in this section of his teaching that we get things like love your enemies, turn the other cheek. We hear Jesus saying don't worry about anything and don't judge other people, and lots of his famous quite radical teaching that I guess in some ways though has become somewhat familiar to us. So we may miss, as we often say here, we may miss the impact that this teaching would have had in its own context, in its own time. So some of what we want to do in this series is kind of unpack it a little bit and see it for its radical nature, see it for its exciting, challenging, inviting nature. So the Sermon on the Mount is where we're going to begin. Now, as we think about the Sermon on the Mount, and as I said, today's kind of some introduction, we just want to get a little bit of context to it, set one or two things up. We'll go over today some of the themes that we'll be pursuing through the series. But the first thing I wanted to mention is this, that you may remember, we've mentioned this a few times before, that Jesus in Matthew's gospel is very often compared to Moses or set up as kind of like a second Moses. Moses was perhaps the most famous of the Hebrew prophets. He was the one who brought the Torah, the law from God, which really was the foundation of the Hebrew religion and culture, really, when you think about it, and is obviously foundational to Judaism today. So Jesus is compared to Moses. Now, that, you know, we saw that in the birth narratives at Christmas. We were talking about how Jesus' birth is compared in many ways to Moses. We've also seen it, I just mentioned that Jesus went into the wilderness for 40 days and nights. Well, that has often been compared to the time that Moses spent with the children of Israel in the wilderness. You know, Moses leads them out of Egypt. They cross a river, the Reed Sea, or the Red Sea as it's become known, and then they're in the wilderness for 40 years. Jesus crosses the River Jordan after his baptism and goes into the desert for 40 days. There's some comparisons there. So Matthew has this comparison of Jesus and Moses. And that's really important to bear in mind, because right at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, the first couple of verses, it says this in chapter 5. Now, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him and he began to teach them. He said, and we'll just hold a moment what he actually says, but Jesus going up a mountain with all the comparisons to Moses is like Moses going up Mount Sinai when he was in the wilderness to get the law, you know, the Ten Commandments and all the other laws that became part of the Torah, the Hebrew law. The difference though, or the connotation here though about that mountain is when Moses went up the mountain, there was thunderbolts and lightning, there was a thick cloud and smoke. Moses had to tell people to wash and prepare themselves because God is so holy, you can't go into the presence of God. It's pretty intimidating and it's very, very dramatic. So this is the context. When Jesus goes up a mountain, we're expecting something spectacular, something dramatic, something a little bit like the first words that come out of Moses' mouth or the first commandment. Does anybody remember what the first commandment, the first thing that is given when Moses comes back down the mountain? Thou shalt have no other gods before me, right? That's pretty sort of setting the scene, right? You imagine if you went to your first day at work and the first thing the boss says is, I am the final authority on everything. Okay, you know, that's sort of setting a tone, right? It's setting a tone. So, but here's what we get from Jesus. Jesus goes up the mountain and then he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So this, I mean, that kind of language doesn't really shock us now because we've read it so often. But that was not what they were expecting to come out of Jesus' mouth. This kind of teaching is new, it's fresh, it's different, it's dramatically different. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I mean, that's like saying to the people who are down and out, people who just feel useless, people who feel like they're losing at life, yours is the kingdom of heaven. So this is intriguing. The way Jesus kicks this off is intriguing. It immediately draws us in, I think. It would have done in those first listeners. I mean, again, we're so familiar with it, we might be able to just dismiss that. Oh yeah, that's Jesus talk. That's the sort of thing that Jesus says all the time. But this is dramatic. It's radical. It's upside down. Now, we've actually called the series. I've got the material here. We have some material. I'll talk about this in a moment. So grab a copy of the material. Lots of great information in there, which I'll go over in a second, but it's available in the Commons outside. But we've called the series Upside Down and Inside Out, or Inside Out and Upside Down. So this Sermon on the Mount is all about the upside down way of Jesus. And that upside down way is what Jesus calls the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is the way or when we live in harmony with God's way, in harmony with God, in harmony with God's way, in harmony with God's will. And we live that kind of what we sometimes refer to here as the divine life, this life of where we're integrated both with God and with one another. And there's this fulfilling, meaningful, whole life that can be lived. It's interesting, actually, what was the intent of that law that Moses had. Moses had all these laws that were meant to bring life and meant to bring health to people. The Torah can perhaps be best translated as the way as opposed to necessarily the law. But it became interpreted as these strict laws, regulations, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. It was all about really trying to force people into a certain set of behaviors. And it wasn't always that successful. And Jesus comes along talking about a similar thing, but in a very different way. He's talking about the kingdom of God. Now, the kingdom of God sounds like it could be also somewhat authoritarian, right? The kingdoms are run by kings. And sometimes we use the language, the rule and reign of God. At Christmas time, we read prophecies about, you know, the government will be on his shoulders, that there will be sort of, you know, this authority that, that Jesus will have in the future. And that, I think, smacks of power and at times domination. But this is a very different kind of kingdom. And there are perhaps, you know, other metaphors we could even use. This is the one that Jesus chose. It's not a kingdom where we are dictated to. It's not a kingdom where there is domination, but a kingdom where love rules and love reigns. And again, that was really the intention of the law as well. If we look at the way the prophets interpreted the law, and we'll look at a couple of quotations here from Ezekiel and from Jeremiah. Here's one from Ezekiel. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Then you will live in the land I gave your ancestors. You will be my people and I will be your God. There's a sense of union here, of harmony, and it's something that's coming from the inside out, right? It's not being forced into change by modifying outward behaviors, but rather something being written on our hearts, something being motivated from within. And I think we all get that, right? When for change to really happen in our lives, we kind of have to get to a point of wanting it, even longing for it. Maybe it's because we've finally realized that we have to change, or the opportunity of change is really enticing to us. But it's so much easier to change and healthier to change when we're motivated from the inside out, rather than forced to just modify our behavior on the outside, right? I think we can all probably relate to that. Jeremiah, another prophet, says this: "This is the covenant I will make with the people of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people." So it's a similar concept. These were prophets from similar eras saying, look, the whole point of this law was that we'd live a really good life, that we'd live that life in harmony with one another, in harmony with God. And that can only happen from the inside out. So this kingdom of heaven that Jesus is talking about, this way of living that's in harmony with God, is upside down. It's surprising. It's the poor in spirit, the meek, the people who are mourning. We'll get into some of this next week. That are no longer viewed as being on the bottom of the pile, but they're kind of lifted up. They're held up. It's an upside down way. It's where you love your enemies rather than hating them. Where you don't judge others. You look at the log in your own eye. You look at your own faults and failings first before pointing the finger at anybody else. It's stuff that isn't necessarily immediately obvious. It can feel counterintuitive. It's upside down, but it's also inside out. It comes from living a life from the inside, where we're honest about what's going on in terms of our inner motivations and the sort of things that drive our outward behaviors. Now, to give you a little illustration of the obvious nature in many ways of the fact that our inner motivations, our inner attitudes really massively impact our outward behaviors. We're just going to take a little look at a video clip from the movie A Night at the Museum. So let's watch this video clip.
What is that?
And I gotta deal with this guy.
So can all relate to that, we all have things going on the inside that manifest as outward behaviors, right? And most of what we see in one another is the outward behaviors. And it's very easy to judge those outward behaviors. I think we very often find it hard to look upon other people with a lot of compassion. But we also struggle, I think, to look at ourselves with compassion. Right? We look at our outward behaviors and we may get feedback about those, you know, when we're out of control or we're not behaving the way we want to, and it can cause shame for us and we can just hide away, and maybe we just try to get by. We try to be socially acceptable. We try to do as much as we can just to, you know, not be too alienated. But it can be a struggle. We've said many times here, you know, three of the fundamental realities of life are the following. All people are nuts, right? And so are we. We're all messed up one way or another. So we know we are. There's stuff that's gone on in our lives, the stuff that we've got on the inside that drives these behaviors that, frankly, most of the time makes us look nuts. But we see that in other people, but we're just the same. Secondly, everyone has a story, and we don't know the half of it. So everybody we encounter, like an angry person, a mean person, whatever, there's a story behind that which doesn't justify it, but it maybe can help us to see people with a little more compassion. And the truth is, we have a story too. And part of what Jesus is getting at with this inside-out approach, I think, is saying, can we get in touch with our stories? Is it safe to be honest about ourselves and look at our own stories? And then thirdly, everyone is doing their best, or at least let's believe that. Right? Sometimes it can be hard to imagine that people are doing their best. But think about ourselves for a moment. I think probably every person in this room would say, I'm doing my best. Sometimes it's really, really hard, but I'm doing my best. I might need more help, and I might need to get over some humps to get more help. Maybe that's part of what I need to do. I need to be more open, more honest about my life. But right now, I'm doing my best. So if we were to look at ourselves in that way, with more compassion, if self-awareness was actually a very compassionate thing, and this is what I think Jesus is getting at with this inside-out approach, if we were to look at ourselves with compassion, because God is compassion, God is love, then maybe we could accept ourselves and begin a journey of change. And not only that, maybe we could look at people around us differently. Maybe that's part of the key to some of Jesus' teachings about not judging others and forgiving our enemies and turning the other cheek. They become way different concepts and a different thing to put into action when we're looking at it, I think, through this lens, than when we're just trying to change our behaviors. I must forgive. I must turn the other cheek. I must not get angry. I must, you know, all these. It doesn't really work like that. So if we can allow some self-awareness in the context of compassion to look at ourselves, we could see ourselves differently and begin a process of change. And we can look at other people differently as well. So for this series, one of the things we're emphasizing upside down, right? If you're feeling poor in spirit, this is for you, this is for me. It's inside out, right? And that can be challenging because it needs honesty and openness. And another theme of this series is stillness, right? We're really emphasizing stillness as a practice throughout the series because stillness gives us an opportunity to do that work of looking at the inside. It also gives us an opportunity to look at our outside, right? What are some of the behaviors? What are some of the ways in which we feel we need to change? And as we go through this Sermon on the Mount, in what ways do we kind of match up to the kind of standard that Jesus is setting? I mean, are we going to say, yeah, got that down? I think probably not. We're going to be challenged by it. And rather than responding in sort of shame or withdrawal, we can stand up to it and say, right, how do we embrace this kind of change that Jesus is calling us to? And stillness is going to give us an opportunity to take a really good, honest look. Now, stillness is a challenge, right? We have all kinds of distractions in our lives. And I want to use a little illustration. It's going to come up here on a video. You imagine our minds, our beings, like a glass of water. Sometimes we feel peaceful, right? And we can see clearly and think clearly and feel clearly. And maybe we could just run the video now. But we also have all sorts of thoughts and feelings, like grains of sand that go into the glass, right? And emotions, and sometimes those emotions themselves can be very distracting to us. And we get into an argument or conflict, or we just feel insecure, and our life gets stirred up, right? We can all relate to this, I think, and we feel somewhat chaotic inside, and it's hard then to take an honest look at ourselves. It's hard to see other people through the lens we were just talking about. We just see things as conflict or competition. So in stillness, we can just turn off our thoughts, tone down our feelings, and just reflect, and then have moments of clarity and calm and peace, in which we're not saying our problems have disappeared, but we can look at them in a different way. So that illustration, I think, is, again, something I think we can probably all relate to. We're going to do those kinds of practices as we go through through this series. So it's upside down, it's inside out, and stillness, we hope, is going to be a key for us. We have, throughout this series, some challenge groups that will be starting. So as I mentioned, the material we have for this series, Inside Out and Upside Down, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. So there's lots of discussion questions in here for each week and lots of other information too. So do grab a copy of this or download it online. The discussion questions are ideal for groups. So you may be in a group already. That's great. You could participate in the discussion questions each week. But we're also starting some new groups that will just last for 3 weeks, as we've done for the last couple of Lents recently. They're challenge groups, and on page 2 of the material, you'll see some information about them. I think we've got a slide. Yeah, so we have a group. So these groups will begin next week and run for 3 weeks, and anybody can go to them. So you may decide, you might be in a group already, and you decide as a group to go along to one of these groups and join in, or you might go your separate ways, or you might not be in a group at the moment. This is a great way to get into a group, for a short-term group, meet some new people, and wrestle with some challenging issues, all of which are kind of different but relate to many of the themes that we're going to be exploring in the Sermon on the Mount. So there's one on racial justice and parenting, looking at the issues of race as it regards raising children in this culture. There's one on contemplative prayer, so looking at different, particularly with stillness in mind, different forms of contemplative prayer are growing in the practice of those. There's one on nature, how nature can be this mindful stillness presence or help draw us into a mindful stillness presence as we engage with nature. There's lots of different ways of experiencing it, but this will be a particular emphasis on stillness. And then there's a group called Help When We're Feeling Stuck. And that, for some of us, we might feel we kind of, especially as we go through the series and touch on different issues, we might feel like, okay, there's some stuff going on the inside that is just overwhelming at the moment. And I don't really know, I can't think my way out of this. I can't feel my way out of this. I can't act my way out of this. I need some help. And I think that happens to us more often than we realize. It's way more common than we realize. The trouble is we find it hard to kind of put our hand up and say, yeah, I need some help at the moment. So there's a group, and all these groups are confidential, of course. So there's a group there, Help When You're Feeling Stuck, which is being led by Roger and Amy, who are a couple of counselors in our community. That will be safe space just to come and talk through some issues and get some help and pointed in a right direction. So those are the challenge groups. And there's a variety there. So please do check those out. You can sign up for a challenge group today in the commons on the table outside. And that will be, I think, be a great way to starts next week. Great way to guide us through this Lent season. Today, we're going to just begin with the end in mind. So, we haven't dug down too much in terms of the material of the Sermon on the Mount, but I just want to look at a couple of a few sections here briefly, which I think show us kind of where we're headed. So what's this all about? And we're going to actually jump to the end of the sermon. It runs three chapters 5, 6, and 7. We're going to jump to the end of chapter 7 to look at some of what the goals of Jesus' teaching are. So let's look at the first one. We're going to look at 4 different metaphors, okay? Actually, the first metaphor comes right at the beginning, so I lied. But the other 3 are all at the end. There's the metaphor of salt and light, good and bad fruit, wide and narrow gates, rock and sand. Okay, so let's look at a scripture where Jesus talks about salt and light. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. So here Jesus is using a metaphor of salt and light. We could ask the question, so right at the beginning of this journey, we could ask the question, what do we taste like? Obviously, I don't mean that literally. But think of it another way. Perhaps use some other metaphors that I think are compatible with what Jesus is saying here. Like, who lives downriver from us? And what is it like living downriver from us? Or put it another, maybe, you know, more dramatic way. Who lives downwind of us? You know, what kind of energy do we bring? What's it like being around us? How do we leave situations better or worse? Do we leave relationships better or worse? Do we leave people better or worse? So thinking through just honestly some of that, and what kind of change are we called to be more salty, to be more light-filled? The next analogy, or the next metaphor comes towards the end. It's good and bad fruit. So let's look at the scripture scripture for that. It's a similar concept, really. By their fruit, you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. So Jesus here is saying, he's talking about the inside-out issue, really. It's like the stuff that's going on the inside, that's going to dictate what happens on the outside. And there's this, remember last week, Ruth was sharing from the talking about the issue of congruence from the life of Eugene Peterson, the term that he used for this sort of matching up, this harmony of what's going on our inside and the kind of life we say we want to live and how we really do live. You know, as we go through this series, we're going to sort of just look at those issues of, okay, where is there a mismatch? And I'll be honest, I feel very apprehensive, honestly, talking about some of these topics because, again, they're very familiar and they sound very nice, but they're super challenging, and it's very easy to pay lip service to them, especially if you're up here, right? I can say all kinds of things. I can vow all kinds of wonderful values, but am I living that? So I feel apprehensive even to try and challenge anybody about these teachings without first saying, okay, I've got to address myself and address the issues in my own life. The next two are not so much about what, but how. It's like the way we go about this. So there's wide and narrow gates, rock and sand. Let's look at the wide and narrow gates. Again, this is right at the end of the sermon. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Now, I remember as a kid reading the scripture and being told that the scripture is basically, you know, the pathway to hell is really wide and easy. And the pathway to heaven is really torturously difficult. And, you know, I don't really think that's what Jesus is talking about here. I think Jesus is just saying, look, this way I'm talking about, it's counterintuitive. It's not obvious. It can be difficult. To turn the other cheek when somebody hits you, that at one level, that does not make sense. That's a narrow gate. The wide gate is you hit them back, right? That's the obvious, because, you know, that's fair, and it's not good. We don't want things to get out of hand. You know, that's the wide gate response. It's the easy response. It's the obvious response. And I think what Jesus is saying here is if we're always doing the obvious things, we might be missing something, because there's something counterintuitive about this. So as we go through the series, it's going to be challenging, and we're going to have to rethink things and perhaps undo some of our thinking in order to see these teachings in a new light. And the second one is similar to this, the rock and the sand. So Jesus tells a story right at the end in which he says this, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who builds his house on the rock. The rain came down, and the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, and the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. So I remember singing songs about that as a kid, actually, and you know, that was a famous Jesus story. And it always struck me, well, you'd be an absolute moron to build your house on sand. I mean, that just it's, and that Jesus uses the word foolish. So, yeah, of course, we're not going to build our houses on sand. But I think the point here, that is obvious, right? That point is obvious. But I think what Jesus is getting at here is, again, this way is hard. It's hard to build on rock, right? If you want to, you can put up anything on sand because it's easy to dig into the sand. It gives. There's an ease to it. But to dig into rock, to chip away at rock and chisel away at rock, that's much more different. It's going to be much more difficult, much more costly. It's going to take a lot longer. But I think Jesus is saying this isn't an instant thing. This isn't something that's just going to happen. This is about laboring and setting our intent very directly on building for the long haul, of addressing areas in our lives that may feel hard and difficult to dig into. And rather than saying, oh, I'm just not going to do it, I'm going to go over to the sand, I'm going to distract myself or take another approach, saying, no, deal with it. Sort of get some purchase on this difficult, hard rock. But over time, it's going to result in a stability, an equilibrium. That means we can't just be thrown around. We're not going to be knocked off kilter. We're going to have a bit, if you think of the image of that glass of water, we're going to be better able to deal with the chaos that comes into our lives. But it's going to be a challenge. So if we're finding it easy, again, probably we might be missing the point. If we're struggling with it and finding it hard and finding like, man, I thought I'd have made more progress than this, then Jesus is saying, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are you. So that's the approach we're going to take. It's going to take time. This sermon is full of metaphor and imagery and poetry. It's not just, you know, we call, sometimes it's called the manifesto of the kingdom of God. Really, in a way, it's not a manifesto. It's much more mysterious and esoteric than that, I think. But we're going to dwell on it and let it percolate. And we're going to come back to it, as we often do in the life of our church here together. And on that score, I wanted to share just briefly to close out here, some of my own story with this Sermon on the Mount, because I remember as a younger person being very drawn to it. There's something very compelling about it. And I wanted to live my life that way. But I also saw, I was part of, you know, church and church systems that didn't seem to behave like that. And I, of course, struggled to behave like that as well. I mean, it's very hard to forgive your enemies. It's very hard to be loving. It's very hard not to judge the poor in spirit, because you're thinking, well, if you're down there and you're struggling like that, you can't really be up to much. You must have done something wrong. You know, it's very hard to live and have the view that Jesus shares in the Sermon on the Mount. And actually, I got totally disillusioned with it. I just thought, this is a load of rubbish. People aren't practicing it. I'm not sure I can practice it. And so I just sort of went off on my own, try to just live life without any sense of the sort of things that Jesus is talking about, having any sense of being honest about what's going on the inside, dealing with your issues, and being in a process of change as a continuum. And as a result of that, actually, my life just began to unravel. And I became the kind of person I didn't want to be, and I had all kinds of anxiety and depression, and I would say probably for a couple of years of my life, I honestly felt like I was living on the edge of a nervous breakdown every day. I could have just let go, and everything would have unraveled. That's how it felt. But in the middle of all that, somewhat out of the blue, to be honest, I had this experience, which I've shared about a little bit before, of God's love. I somehow knew, despite my being so messed up, that I was loved, that love is at the heart of the universe, that God is love. And that began to transform me, began to give me hope. And I came back to the way of Jesus and following this way and the Sermon on the Mount again. And yeah, love your enemies and be gentle. Don't be pushy. The meek will inherit the earth. And if we were just loving and forgiving and accepting, everything would be wonderful. Except that most of the time, it doesn't work. Right? That was my experience. It's like, since that time, I've been on this journey of trying to live it, which is in tension with getting frustrated and kind of angry at Jesus, to be honest, and saying, I'm not sure this works, because you know what? The pushy do get ahead. You can say to somebody, please, you go first, and they take the first option, right? When we say to somebody, You know, when we have a humble response to somebody, they're not saying back to us, oh, blessed art thou. Very often, they're using us as a stepping stone to get ahead because they've got all their own insecurities and all their own inside stuff going on. When we turn the other cheek, it's not like we get a kiss on the other one necessarily. Right? When we forgive people, or I don't know if you've ever done this, where you think, okay, I'm going to try and take the higher ground here. I feel like I've been wrong, but I was involved as well, so I'm going to take the higher ground and be the first to ask for forgiveness. Very often what you get back is, yes, thank you for admitting that you're wrong, right? You know, we want to think it's going to be all rainbows and unicorns from there out as we usher in this way of love, but it's just not like that. And many of when Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, is Jesus really meaning blessed are the poor in spirit? Because actually, if you follow my way, eventually you'll get on top. And what I think what we have to bear in mind is this is not some secret alternative way of getting from the bottom to the top. The disciples thought it was that. So they're always saying, Jesus, when your kingdom comes, will I be number one or number two in the hierarchy? Will I be number one or number two in the pecking order? Because they thought that's what was going to happen. Like upside down would actually get reversed and it would be downside up. But I don't think that's what Jesus is talking about. Because the pathway of Lent that we're walking ends with Easter. It ends with a cross. I mean, this living a life of forgiveness, of love, of gentleness, of meekness will get you crucified. I think that's the message of Jesus, right? That's the message of Jesus. It doesn't mean that it's a way for you now to have the upper hand and we're sort of all back to square one. There's a sacrifice to this. So what's the point then? What's the point of it? Because we know that there's a cross, but there's also resurrection. We're going to be celebrating both of those at Easter. There's resurrection. There's life in this way. Living this way changes the order of things. It's like we're changing the atmosphere. We're changing the flow of the universe, if you like, if you want to think of it in cosmic terms and somewhat esoteric terms. We're changing incarnation, or we are being incarnate, right? The incarnation, the mystery of the incarnation for me is not Jesus being born. I mean, I don't know how much Jesus had to do with that, really. It was more Mary, right? Probably not Joseph, anyway. It's more to do with Mary. The mystery of the incarnation is that Jesus embodied this life. Jesus lived this life. At every moment, there was a choice to forgive or not to forgive, to love or to hate. And even at the point of death, he's strung up on a cross and nailed there, and he says, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. He lived this life to the end, and Jesus is changing the atmosphere. We're here because of what Jesus did, right? We're following because of what Jesus did. So over time, and again, this is slow, it doesn't happen instantly, over time, things are changed, systems change, powers change, darkness is changed, systems come tumbling down. I think that's what the scriptures mean when it talks about all knees will bow and all kings will submit to the way of Jesus. You know, that kind of language, I think we can interpret that as either Jesus is going to come back and kick butt and take names and actually it's all going to go back to the power way, or over time, if we live this way, light will triumph over darkness. Love will triumph over hate. Forgiveness will triumph over unforgiveness. And we are being invited into that kind of life. And it's sacrificial. But I think Jesus is saying, the future is in your hands. The future is in our hands. And he's saying to us, blessed are the meek. Not because one day you'll be in charge or one day you'll have all the power, but blessed are the meek because the future is yours. You will inherit the earth, Jesus says. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. And I think when Jesus says, blessed are you, it's not because you're going to be somewhere else, but it's almost like, blessed are you. Thank you for living that way. Thank you for living this way and following these teachings, following in my way. And Jesus can only say that because Jesus embodies it. Right at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, this is the very end, Matthew closes off every discourse of Jesus with the same saying. When Jesus had finished saying these things, dot, dot, dot. Okay, you'll see that in Matthew all over the place. But at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, it says, the crowds were amazed at his teaching because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. I don't think this is because Jesus is he had a better teaching. You know, maybe he had a better PowerPoint or something like that, or he just researched it better. I don't think it's anything to do with that, right? This is the fact that he means what he says because they see his life and Jesus lives this out. That's what the authority is. And so we really have nothing to say. I have nothing to say, and I mean that legitimately, and you've had to listen to me for 30-odd minutes, so you know, I do get that. But I have nothing to say if I'm not living it, if I'm not on this journey. I don't have to be perfect, right? It's a process. But the authority, the meaning comes in embodying this, and Jesus did that. That's who we're following. That's what's at stake here. Following Jesus, the future being in our hands. So this is big stuff. It's really important stuff. Stuff that's exciting, but really challenging at the same time. So let's just close out here. We're going to sing a song to close, but we're just going to take a moment of silence, a moment of stillness. And the light's going to go down a little bit. And I would just encourage you to close your eyes. And we're just going to do a couple of minutes here, and we're going to start an exercise that you can, you'll find this stillness exercise in the material if you want to do this a little bit longer later. But let's just quietly center ourselves and focus on our breathing, right? That's a simple way to center ourselves. Take some breaths in and out. You don't have to breathe heavily, just notice your breathing. Focus on that. And then let's just imagine this room filled with God's love. Like we are in this love. We are completely loved, completely accepted right now. Just imagine, that might be a struggle, but just imagine it. That there's nothing about you that is being judged. Nothing about you that is not loved. So breathe that love in. Just breathe it in. And breathe out the fear that we're not loved. The fear of insignificance. Just receive that love. And as you get, if you do get distracted from that, just return to your breathing. But just focus on breathing in God's love. And as you get that kind of rhythm going, just open your heart in the stillness to what needs to change. And that might be something on the outside. It might be a behavior, a situation. Or you might even see it on the inside. It might be, okay, there's issues on the inside that I have already identified. And in the atmosphere of love and acceptance where you're not being judged, just be honest about that. Just open your heart and identify some things. Okay, so we're going to sing a song now, and let's sing this song with hope that whatever you touched on there, whatever you thought about there, that it's safe to go on a journey with that. Like in this series and beyond this series, that there's hope for change, that life can be different, we can be different. So let's sing this song with hope in the atmosphere of God's complete love.